start. I'm going to talk about the political fight that predated Plato, that Plato actually wrote about in his dialogues, and then the political fight that Plato himself was engaged in. And it probably won't be a big surprise to find out that the enemies of Plato, the enemies of Socrates, the people who helped undermine the great classical culture of Greece, were the exact philosophical predecessors of the Straussians that Phil was just talking about. You look at what Phil developed, what we've got in our Children of Satan pamphlet and so on. I mean, these guys just fought a war against a country on a basis of lies. That is one of their commandments, thou shalt lie. But they said to the American they justified this attack on Iraq on the basis of lies. Lies which, you could take about 35 seconds to figure out were lies, like we're attacking Iraq because of 9/11. Uh-huh. And what's the connection between Iraq and 9/11? There wasn't any. Every silly little proof they tried to come up with got shot down by everybody in the international community immediately. But they simply told these lies to the American population, and the average American stuck his American flag on the front lawn and said, I love George Bush. They lied about 9/11. Again, you didn't have to be an intelligence expert to see that there were probably some problems with the story they told. Like what happened to U.S. defenses, how did Osama bin Laden strip security over Washington, D.C., and so on. Obvious lies, but lies which they told to the American population and were then the basis of actually shaping our policy. They lied about the economy. They've been lying about the economy for 30 years. They lied about the wonders of deregulation. They said to sold deregulation to the American population from the standpoint that you were going to get your utilities cheaper. Now, here's another one. Take about 5 seconds to think about this. Remember what utilities used to cost before deregulation? Except in a heavy winter, like $20 a month. How are you going to get it cheaper? But, all you had to do was lie to the American population. They swallowed the lies and we shaped policy. Now, this question of manipulating a population on the basis of, frankly, obvious lies, on the basis of the manipulation of public opinion, is the fundamental question that Plato faced over 2,400 years ago. Because what Plato wrote about, what Plato saw happen to his city-state, his nation, it wasn't really a nation at the time, in the 100 years before, in the 125 years before he was writing, is in essence a classical tragedy, a classical tragedy for which there was a sublime solution, and it was called Socrates and it was called Plato. But if you look at, and I'll go into more detail on the history of this a little bit later on, but just to locate what the paradox actually is. In 490 B.C., Athens and their allies defeated the greatest oligarchical force on the planet, the Persian Empire. In fact, just so you can get a sense of this. Persia was the oligarchy of the day. There were various versions of this. Earlier nations had represented this kind of conquering, looting, parasitical society. It just so happened in the period of time that we're talking about, the oligarchy was using the Persians, just like today the oligarchy is using the office of the presidency of the United States. Doesn't mean Americans are oligarchs, but that was the institution they were using. And the Persians were pretty successful. All of the gray up here is the area. Here's Persia here. And all of this area, both east and west, all the way over to Egypt, up into Turkey, what's now the Balkan region and so on, was conquered by the Persians. Now this little black area here is Greece. It wasn't very big. And the Persians obviously were, it seemed unstoppable. This, the great civilization of Egypt, which I'll talk about more later on, was conquered by the Persians. They were able to get that far into Africa and so on. And yet, at the famous Battle of Marathon, which we'll deal with a little bit later, a tiny contingent of Greeks who numbered one-third of the Persian contingent stopped the Persians, defeated them, completely routed them. And the Persian conquest of the known world was stopped as a result of that. So that is in 490 BC, and the Persians kept trying. There was another battle in 480, the naval battle of Salamis, and again, I'll deal with some of this a little bit later. But obviously, you had embedded in Greek civilization some capacity, some kind of power, which allowed them to do something that, no other civilization up to that point had done. And yet, less than 100 years later, Athens had destroyed itself by engaging in a civil war with Sparta. This was the Peloponnesian War. And destroying itself in 399, Athens executed its greatest truth seeker up to that point, namely Socrates, and was shattered. It was a shard. Now, Plato was a student of Socrates. I think he was in his early 20s when Socrates was executed in 399. And Plato was faced with the question of how did this happen? What happened to the great culture of Greece, which had stopped the Persians, which had given great drama, great architecture, great poetry to mankind in the previous period? What had actually happened to Greece? And this is really the subject of Plato's dialogues, the historical subject of Plato's dialogues. Now, the fundamental question, and it's the question that Phil referred to, it's the question that Lyndon LaRouche always comes back to, which Plato deals with in a very beautiful metaphorical way, which many of you are familiar with, but it's always worth it to rethink the importance of this, is how does a human being, as opposed to an animal, actually know the universe? An animal knows the universe through sense impressions. A human being knows the universe through his mind. And Plato develops this in the beautiful analogy of the shadows on the wall of the cave. This question is actually fundamental to whether or not a civilization is going to survive or not. Because the question of what you think is real, and therefore how you make your decisions, how you act in society, is actually going to determine whether or not you're successful in your society. So just to review once again, and for some of you who are not familiar with this, the question of Plato's cave. What Plato says is that our senses are only showing us shadows. It's as if we were only able to see the back of a cave wall and could never move our heads, and all we could see are the shadows on the cave wall. And your senses, what your senses show you, you know, you looking at me, me looking at you, and so on, in reality, these are actually shadows. They're not telling you the actual physical substance of the universe, because the physical substance of the universe is actually unknowable, unseeable, rather, to the human senses. But this question of societies which consider the shadows to be real is exactly how the oligarchy manipulates. It's exactly how the oligarchy controls populations. I mean, you want to see the ultimate shadow on the wall, go turn on your television set. I mean, the television is the ultimate example of the shadows on the cave wall. It has absolutely nothing to do with reality, deliberately. It's not the case that you might not find some way to use the medium in a slightly better way, but I can think of better mediums to use. But the media in the United States today is nothing but the shadows on the cave wall. And as long as you think they're real, they've got you. They're manipulating you. And that's what how the American population has been functioning increasingly, almost entirely, over the course of the last 30 years. Now, contrary to thinking that the shadows are real, the question is what actually is real? And if you can't see it with your senses, how can you actually see it? Well, Lyndon LaRouche, in a recent document, put this in a very beautiful, simple way. This is his piece on the weird religions of Dick Cheney. And he discusses the Platonic notion of powers. In Greek, it's the word dunamis, you know, and you can think about it from the standpoint of words like dynamite, a lot of power. I mean, it's from essentially the same root and so on. But what Plato means by powers, as Lynn discusses it in this recent piece, is he says, the notion of powers, as this is illustrated by Plato, signifies the power to reach out to a discoverable universal principle existing beyond the reach of sense perception, and by that means to impose successfully, by action so informed, our will to change the order among the shadows, among the observed phenomenon. In other words, it's by knowing what causes the shadows and acting on those principles that you have the power to change what the shadows are actually doing. And he recasts it in the following way. He said, it is only through our uniquely human ability to change the behavior of the shadow world by willful means, by powers not accessible to perception, that we know with certainty that the real unseen world exists as a subject of human knowledge. Now, this is the fundamental question which Plato was dealing with, because as opposed to living in a world where you think the shadows are real, so of course whoever controls the shadows controls you. And that is the not-so-secret secret of the oligarchy over 2,500 years. And this is an idea upon which civilizations rise or fall. Whether you're actually operating on the basis of universal principles, which can be seen in this way through your mind, but not through your senses, or whether you're going to be manipulated by the shadow world of your senses. And just as it's relevant to the success or failure of our society and our civilization today, this was the issue 2,500 years ago. And the battle which predated Plato and the battle which Plato then continued was very much based on these ideas. Now, to locate historically for people where this great classical culture of Greece actually came from, because one of the things which always used to frustrate me, and is probably frustrating to other people, is you feel like you're sort of floating in space and time, and you have no idea where you are and when you are and when anything happened, and so on. The oligarchy, especially when it comes to dealing with ancient civilizations, makes sure that you are completely confused and completely lost. I mean, one of the things you almost never find is a book which actually will take more than one civilization and let you know what things were happening at the same time in different parts of the world. So, you know, figures that you're all familiar with, Moses, the Trojan War, the building of the pyramids, the classical period in Greece, things which happened in the Old Testament and the Bible, for example. What is the relationship of any of these things to each other? The oligarchy makes sure that you have absolutely no idea. You almost have to construct your own timeline, which is what I do whenever I can. So, I mean, just to give you, again, a certain sense of where we are in time, I want to give you a sweep of the period which leads up to the founding of classical Greece. As those who were here Wednesday discussed, as we discussed, Egypt is undoubtedly a much older civilization than the textbooks and the academics claim. But let's just take, for the sake of argument, the most recent period of Egyptian history, which starts in about 2600 BC. This is you basically have three kingdoms in Egypt, and in the article I have in the New Federalist, I try and just give people an overview of this, again, so you know where you are, at least in time. The Old Kingdom of Egypt lasted from about 2700 BC to about 2200 BC. I mean, there's disputes over 100 years here, 20 years there. Don't worry about the specifics. Just try and get the general idea. And Egypt fell into disarray around 2200 BC and recovered around 2000 BC, and you had what was called the Middle Kingdom of Egypt. The Old Kingdom, by the way, the first one, is when the Great Pyramids were actually built. Then there was one of the few times in this early period that Egypt was conquered. It was conquered by a group which in Egyptian it simply meant the shepherds. The Egyptian word is Hyksos. For a while people thought it meant a race of people, but it was just a nomadic series of tribes. And they conquered Egypt for a period of time. And then you had the new kingdom of Egypt, which began in about 1500 B.C. and lasted for about 1300 B.C. It's towards the end of that period that you have Moses, if you want to stick him in this chronology. Yeah, Rich.
What was the date for the Middle Kingdom then?
The Middle Kingdom is about 2000 to 1700 B.C. Now, this is a long time for this civilization. I mean, you know, let's all try and be a little humble here about the fact that the United States is hardly, you know, is only a little more than 200 years old. You're talking about 2700 B.C. to 1300 B.C. This is, 1400 years that you're talking about. This is a tremendous continuity for a civilization. And one of the key institutions that maintain the continuity of ideas in Egypt was the priests, who are more properly called the priest astronomers, the priest geometers, the priest mathematicians, because it was through the various temples, especially the temple of Ammon, and you'll see Lyndon LaRouche reference this quite a bit, that the ancient knowledge of astronomy, of geometry, of looking at these universal principles was maintained and transmitted even through various political upheavals that took place in Egypt. But most of the Mediterranean region went into a fairly chaotic period of time after 1300. And again, so we're also back in space as well as time. Let's just get our bearings here in terms of what we're talking about. This is the Mediterranean Sea, so that can, you know, these are kingdoms, Assyria, Babylonia, Persia. Here's Egypt down here. Here's what today we call the Mideast. And then here's Greece over here. This is an important island, Crete. It's not located, it's not identified here. This is what is later a Greek colony in Egypt called Cyrenaica. We're going to hear a lot about that later. And these islands here on the coast of Turkey were all Greek settlements. So just so you sort of know where on the globe we actually are at this point. Now, and this much of this entire region does go into a dark age. Egypt goes into a period of chaos and collapse around 1300. The famous Trojan War, I'm not tall enough, it's right there. Troy is right there on the corner of Turkey. Oh, yeah, but then you can't see the rest of it. Oh, okay. Oh, but that's no fun. All right. Can everybody see it if it's down this low?
Yeah, I'll put it up for you.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, well, there we are. Troy is way up there. Troy is right here. Shadows on the wall. This is the real thing that makes it. The Trojan War is about 1195 B.C., you know, let's say 1200 B.C., just so we can sort of keep it in general, generally broad sweep of things. And the Trojan War was a disaster because the Greeks, you know, left their homes in Greece to go fight for over a decade over a woman, you know, who had gone off with live in Troy. And as a result of that, and probably that's a metaphor for larger stupid decisions made by the Greeks at that time, Greek society went into a collapse as well. The civilizations of the Hittites, which is in what is now Turkey, also collapsed. So you're out almost this entire region. You have a real wreck. Yeah.
Who was the woman?
Helen of Troy. The face that launched 1,000 ships, as they say. And again, I'm sure that's a metaphor for a whole series of stupid decisions that were made, but it gets the point across. And the mainland Greece here actually goes into a dark age for about 400 years, because prior to the Trojan War, you had a civilization in Greece which was literate. It was Greek-speaking. They had an alphabet which was not the alphabet we're used to. So it's the same language, but a different alphabet. It was called Linear B, and it wasn't translated until the 1950s. But they were literate. They had a language. They had a culture. They had pottery. They had an economy. You know, they had a working civilization, a decent civilization, which went into complete collapse. The literacy was lost. This alphabet was lost. I mean, what the alphabet meant was lost and wasn't discovered until deciphered until the 1950s and so on. There was massive depopulation in Greece during this period of time. I think the population fell by certainly more than a half throughout mainland Greece. And you went into a general period of a dark age, out of which you began to see a recovery around 800 BC. And this is the time of Homer. And Homer's two great epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey, if you read them from the standpoint that they're being written at the end of a dark age in order to illuminate what had happened that led to the dark age, they've got a particular kind of dramatic richness. The Iliad, I think, explores more the flawed axioms which led to the collapse of Greece, of mainland Greece. The Odyssey, I think, is a little more hopeful in terms of beginning to give you a hint of where you find the solution to these problems. But these great epics were very much from the standpoint of beginning to educate a population so that it would not repeat the mistakes that had led to this 400-year dark age. And while the academics, you know, talk about the great classical age of Greece being around 450, we'll get to that, I really think the classical age of Greece is much more launched around 600 BC, because this is when you begin to see really great breakthroughs in science, in statecraft, and geometry. Because 600 BC is the time that you have Solon of Athens, the great lawgiver, whom Lyndon LaRouche often talks about. And we have on the Schiller Institute website, translated by David Shaven, who is known to some of you, a translation of Solon's so-called constitutional poem, which is really very powerful if you think about it from 600 BC. Because what he says to the Athenian population is, don't blame the gods for your problems. You know, it's your own greed, it's your own stupidity, it's your own refusal to live a harmonious life, which is the cause of your problems. I mean, you can see in that poem the seed crystal of the idea of a republic. Because what is a republic? It's a civilization which is based on submitting itself to universal laws, living in harmony with universal laws, not what popular opinion happens to say at a particular moment. So Solon, along with the other great figures that I'm going to mention at this particular time, traveled to Egypt and was very much immersed in the knowledge, the scientific, astronomical, geometrical knowledge of the Egyptians. Whether he learned something about statecraft from the Egyptians, I don't know, because it's really very hard to know what Egyptian statecraft looked like. I mean, there's not that much extant sources on that would really be very credible. But certainly from the standpoint of science, certainly from the standpoint of astronomy, geometry, the great figures of around this period of time, Solon the lawgiver, Thales the geometer and the astronomer, and Pythagoras, who I'll talk about even more, all traveled to Egypt. Because Egypt during this period, and really in the entire period of recovery from the Dark Age, the Egyptians were sending out colonies. The Egyptians were battling for their lives against a series of invasions, the last of which was the Persians that we saw, but they were invaded and conquered by the Babylonians, and then the Assyrians, and then finally in the 6th century, the Persians. So they were under tremendous attack. And what they did is they essentially sent out colonies of ideas into Greece, into Ionian Greece along here, and then I don't have Italy on this map, but also into Italy. Now, the degree to which Athens really owes its origin to Egyptian culture, besides what we've talked about in the previous class in terms of astronomy, geometry, and so on. The name, the name Athena, the goddess of Athens, from which Athens comes, is not a Greek word. It is a word which is an inversion of the Egyptian goddess Nais, and that's where the name Athens and Athena actually comes from. It's the name of an Egyptian goddess. So this colonization of the Egyptians was very, very serious.
How do you spell that name,
Neith? N-E-I-T-H. And don't ask me if I'm pronouncing it right, because I haven't talked to any ancient Egyptians who can tell me. N-E-I-T-H. That's more the goddess that you're probably thinking of, Mat. That was the goddess of justice, wisdom, balance, and so on. But she was a pretty good goddess. She wasn't one of the more witch-like goddesses, and there were some of those. I mean, Egypt really has ensured. Yeah, you had a question? Or you were just.
Athens was a colony of the Egyptians.
Yeah. In fact, I think Herodotus says there were three foundings of Athens, and really the only one we know about historically is the latest one. So you figure what the previous two, you know, and how much earlier they may have been. So what Egypt has actually done during this period of time, even though they're under attack, even though they're in the process of being conquered and briefly liberating themselves and being conquered, they've planted these ideas in Greece and among the Greek colonies, because these were Greek colonies, and Sicily and Italy, which aren't on this map, were also Greek colonies. So I really think if you want to talk about the classical period of Greece, to talk about the period from Solon and Thales and Pythagoras, who I'll say much more about later, from 600 BC, really through Aeschylus in around 450 BC, that's the classical period. What the academics call the classical period, the golden age of Pericles, I'll come back to. It wasn't so golden. In fact, it was the actual collapse of Athens was caused by Pericles, as far as I'm concerned. Now, to go back to what I started with in terms of the power embedded in these ideas in Greece society and the power that it gave them, I want to just show you what the Battle of Marathon actually looked like in terms of numbers, because this really does give you a sense of why an idea, a set of axioms, is what gives you power, not something which is physical. This is the first day of the Battle of Marathon. There were 20,000 to 30,000 Persians. These are the Persians, and there's more of them back here waiting in reinforcements. There were 11,000 Greeks, and these are the Greeks. So they were outnumbered 3-1 or 2-1. And as you remember from that previous map, the Persians had never been conquered. I mean, they had swept over everything. This is the second day of the battle. And what the Greeks did is they drew the Persians into a frontal attack, you know, and the Persians were totally arrogant because they had conquered everything. And then they flanked them. What led to the superiority of the Athenians? First of all, look at this. Dead. 192 Greeks, 6,400 Persians. Now, you know.
That's
on land. Yeah, there's a naval battle about 10 years later, which I'll talk about. Now, what was it that allowed this outnumbered force to, I mean, deliver this devastating defeat and the Persians put their tails between their legs and they went back to Persia. They didn't try again for 10 years. It was several things. The Greeks had a concept of what they were fighting for. The Persian army was largely a mercenary army or a slave army, so they had no reason to fight. The Greeks had obviously superior tactics. I mean, they knew it wasn't just brute force that would necessarily win a battle. And they also had superior technology. the Persians were running around with these little hide shields, and the Greeks had these huge shields that were about this tall and were curved this way. So you had this shield in front of you like this, and you would have this phalanx of Greeks, you know, with these shields. You know, it was an absolutely impenetrable being able to march forward with these shields in a coordinated kind of way, and then people behind them. And the shields were made out of metal. I mean, these guys had to be really strong. I mean, because these battles would go on for hours, and they're holding these shields, which God knows how many pounds they weigh. But they believed in the harmony of the body as well as the mind with the universe, so they exercised a lot. And they were very disciplined, so that if somebody actually did fall, someone else would pick up the shield, and, you know, this impenetrable wall of shields would not be broken. So they had a superior conception of what they were fighting for. They had superior tactics, and they had superior technology. And then they did the same thing again, essentially 10 years later. The Persians got their act together. They tried to attack again. This time it was a naval battle. They had a lot more ships, a lot bigger ships, and the Athenians lured them in to a very narrow strait. The Athenians had much more mobile ships, much better trained sailors in terms of maneuverability, and they just trapped the Persians in the Straits of Salamis, and they just slaughtered them because they couldn't move these big boats and so on. So the Persians turned tail and ran again. Now, there was another element in terms of the Athenians' ability to do this. All the other civilizations throughout Ionian Greece and coming back down to the Battle of Marathon. And if anybody wants to know where Marathon is, how many miles in a marathon? Yeah, Marathon is 26 miles away from Athens, because that's where the number comes from, because news of the Battle of Marathon was carried back to Athens by one runner who ran the marathon. So that's where it comes from. there was one other advantage that the Athenians had that the other societies didn't, and that is the Athenians did not listen to the Fox TV of the day. The Fox TV of the day was called the Oracle of Delphi. And the Oracle of Delphi was run by the oligarchs. It was run by the Persians, according to Lyndon LaRouche, and someday he'll let me know what his source on that is. I'm sure it's true. I just don't know how he knows that. I sometimes suspect he was there when he says something like that. But the Oracle of Delphi, the way the oracle worked is you would have a priestess, and she would sit over a crevice, which below it were burning eucalyptus leaves, and she would get stoned, and she would start to babble. Complete nonsense. And then the priest would come out, and if you paid him, he would tell you what she was actually saying. So what the Oracle of Delphi told all the other city-states to do, you know, everyone would go to the Oracle and say, you know, what should we do? Should we fight the Persians? And guess what the Oracle told them all to do? Surrender. So the Persians really didn't have a whole lot of opposition on their way into Greece. But when they reached the Athenians were, this was the first time that somebody didn't consult the Oracle. They didn't listen to Fox TV. They actually made their decision to fight on the basis of a consideration of what was best for their society. They made a political decision based on their best estimate of what was truthfully best for their society. And that probably, besides everything else, was one of the key reasons why the Athenians defeated the Persians and did not succumb as everybody else did. But imagine what the Persians did at that point. They figured, actually much as the British did after the American Civil War, which was a British attempt to destroy us, they decided, since they couldn't defeat us militarily, and the Persians decided the same thing, since they couldn't defeat the Athenians militarily, they had to break their commitment to the truth. They had to get them, like everybody else, to start listening to Fox TV. And that's the philosophical, that's the epistemological battle that Plato is actually writing about. Now, what form did this actually take? Go back again to the previous century. Go back to the period from 600 to 500 BC. And again, just so you don't get confused, that's the 6th century. From 500 to 600 BC is the 6th century BC. And that was the century that, remember, that began with Solon, it began with Thales. But the other key figure during this period was Pythagoras. Pythagoras was born on one of these Ionian Greek islands, which I don't think is identified. It's called Samos, and it's right around here somewhere. He was born on this island, but at the age of about 22, he visited with Thales, the great geometer and astronomer, who is also from this part of Greece, an Ionian Greek. And Thales encouraged him to go to Egypt. So Pythagoras did, and he spent the next 22 years in Egypt working with learning the ideas of geometry, astronomy, science from the priests in Egypt. And then after 22 years, he went back to the island. Now, I should step back a minute. The period of time in which Thales, Pythagoras, and Solon traveled to Egypt was one of the brief periods of time when the Egyptians actually liberated themselves from the conquerors in this period. And you had a great pharaoh in Egypt called Amasis, who was in Egypt, it's in my article, he liberated Egypt in about 470 BC from the Persians. And he ruled, he finally died in about 426, and his son lost Egypt to the Persians in about 425. But this period between 470 and 425 BC is when all these Greeks are traveling to Egypt. Amasis is a friend of the Greeks. In fact, he married a Greek and is rebuilding Egypt and so on. The leader of the island that Pythagoras came from, Polycrates, had been an ally of Amasis against the Persians, and then he switched sides. And it was during that period of time that Pythagoras left Samos and went to Italy to form a colony there, which I have no doubt was done in collaboration with the Egyptians. And this is where the Pythagorean community was actually established in Italy. Pythagoras never was in mainland Greece. He was born on these islands, traveled to Egypt, went back to the islands, and then established his colony in Italy. And the Pythagoreans are really the key link between Egypt and between Greece. If you want to, there are no writings of Pythagoras that exist, and there's almost no writings of the next generation of Pythagoreans. But if you want to understand the Pythagorean outlook, Plato's great masterwork, the Timaeus, is essentially based on Pythagorean principles. And it's clear that the ideas of the Pythagoreans were among the key ideas that helped shape the development of mainland Greece, the power that mainland Greece had to defeat the Persians in 490 and in 480 was very much an outgrowth of the work of the Pythagoreans, the Egyptians, and so on. Now, the Pythagoreans weren't the only guys rattling around Italy, because, not surprisingly, the Persians, the Oracle of Delphi, wanted to deploy against the Pythagoreans. And a contrary philosophical school was founded in Italy during essentially the same period of time that Pythagoras was there. This is the school of the Eleatics. Now, these are the great, 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 however many times you want to say it, grandfather of the existentialists and Leo Strauss. This is where they come from, and they come from there very directly, which I'll go through in a minute. Parmenides was the most famous Eleatic. We're familiar with him through the Parmenides Dialogue of Plato, which is probably his most intense dialogue. I actually think, for dramatic reasons, Plato makes Parmenides better than he is in that dialogue. But the basic principle of the Eleatics is fairly straightforward. And at first glance, it seems like they might be on the right track. Because the basic principle of Parmenides, which he outlines in a very strange poem called The Way of the Truth, is that you can't know the truth with your senses. Well, isn't that what we just said? You know, all you can know is shadows. You cannot know the truth through your senses. And originally, when I was first looking at this, I was asking myself the question, okay, so maybe the Eleatics were legitimate and they just didn't make the next breakthrough, which Plato makes, which is that you can know through your mind what you can't know through your senses. So I had a chance to ask Lynn this about 3 or 4 years ago. And I said, who are the, you know, so what are the Eleatics? He says, Oracle of Delphi. I said, okay. And he said, you know, who else was there in Italy with the Eleatics? I said, the Pythagoreans. And he said, where did the Pythagoreans come from? I said, Egypt. He says, that's it. So that was the end of the conversation. But that's enough, because if you actually look at the impact of this Eleatic philosophy, which is, since you can't know the truth through your senses, you can't know the truth. You can't know the truth. The truth is mystical, and that's his poem gets mystical, and, you know, a goddess inducts him into some secret mysteries and so on and so forth. But you cannot know the truth. The truth, to Parmenides, is one blob. The one is a blob. It is undefinable. It has no parts. It has no motion. It has no shape. It's nothing. It is the one, and you can't know it. Now, there's an outgrowth of the Eleatics, because what Parmenides is essentially saying is you can't know the truth through your senses, so you can't know the truth. Then you get a later, sort of the next generation, degeneration of the Eleatics is the Sophists. And the Sophists say, you can't know the truth. The Sophists take it one step further. They say, there is no truth. Since nobody can prove to you what the truth is because you can't know it, they simply argue, there is no truth. So that takes you directly to the Straussians, who say there is no truth. And in fact, the Sophists are, the Eleatics and the Sophists are the predecessors of the Straussians, and their argument basically is, since there is no truth, how do you govern society? Well, for the Sophists, the nice way, the smiling way, was whoever gives the best speech wins. What the Sophists were was master rhetoricians. You know, they knew how to use their voice and embellish their oratory and so on to convince you, not on the basis of anything truthful, but just on the basis of emotion. You know, the way political candidates today run for office, you know, which is pure sophistry. Now, there's another side to the Sophists. Thrasymachus, the key figure in Book 2 of Plato's Republic, was a very, very famous sophist. And if you remember, and this is the key argument that LaRouche talks about in terms of the turning point, this early turning point in the Republic, Thrasymachus does not say whoever gives the best speech wins, although he does that. He gets a lot of money for teaching people how to give the best speech. Thrasymachus says that since there is no truth, you rule society on the basis of whoever is the strongest. That's his argument. That justice is whoever has the power to impose what they want on society. And that is the Straussians. Now, about a year ago, or 2 years ago, when I was trying to figure out this Parmenides Eleatic Sophist thing, I just did a web search for books on Parmenides to see if I could find some books on his history or his philosophy or something like that. And it turns out all of the 20th century books written on Parmenides and the Eleatics are by Martin Heidegger, Friedrich Nietzsche, Hannah Arendt. Someone showed me the obituary for William Yandell Elliott, the father of the Southern Agrarians, who's another version of this. And his son, in his obituary, describes him as a true Eleatic. Because this... what the existentialists, the fascists, the Straussians, the swamp they have to swim in is the swamp which says there is no truth. Either you can't know the truth or there is no truth. So they are you know, let's call the Straussians today not only the children of Satan, but the great 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 grandchildren of the Eleatics. Now, how did this actually affect Greek society? I should tell you that this was not simply a philosophical battle, because the community of the Pythagoreans, at a certain point, were in Croton, Italy, were all murdered. Pythagoras was either not there or he escaped, but around 500 BC, although there's a dispute over the date, 500 BC, 450 BC, but the main community of Pythagoreans was trapped in their house and they were all burned to death. So, and only a few of them actually escaped. Yeah.
Wait, and just the chronology.
Yeah.
Do you know what time Pythagoras died or lived?
He lived from about 570 BC. Dies sometimes around 500 BC. So you think about it. He dies. The Pythagoreans are almost wiped out physically, although obviously their ideas aren't, 10 years before the Battle of Marathon. But the ideas, obviously, the Egyptians and the Pythagoreans had been successful. They had planted their ideas in Athenian society, and that's what Athenian society was flourishing on the basis of. So,
Egypt 30 years after the Pythagoreans are destroyed?
No, before. Amasis is basically parallel with the flourishing of the Pythagoreans and Plato. In fact, Pythagoras, I mean, again, some of these dates, especially for Pythagoras, are guesses, but it's guessed he was born about 570 BC. That's the same year, that's pretty much the same year Amasis liberates Egypt.
Okay. You said 470.
Sorry, I mix up fours and fives, so catch me on that. So it's, Amasis, the Pythagoreans, the Eleatics, they're all in this same century. Solon and Thales are all in this century. And again, even though the Pythagoreans are pretty much wiped out, the ideas had been successfully planted, and Greek society begins to flourish. And again, I consider this the period which includes from Solon in 600 B.C., the Pythagoreans, with the defeat of the Persians in 490 and 480, through Aeschylus's great plays in 470, 460, and so on. This I consider the classical period of Greece. Aeschylus, by the way, fought at the Battle of Marathon, and even though he was the greatest dramatist of all times, the only thing he wanted on his gravestone was he fought at Marathon, and that's the only thing that is on it. So the infection, however, begins in Greece, and it's brought in through the Eleatics and through the Sophists. Now, again, Plato is writing after the death of Socrates. Socrates is executed in 399 BC, and Plato is writing after that. But what he's really writing about is this process of the battle of ideas, between his ideas, between the ideas of man knowing the universe through his mind, and the infection of the Eleatics and the Sophists. And all of his dialogues reflect this battle in one form or another. Because the actual degeneration begin to seep in? This gets to the question of Pericles, supposedly the leader of Athens in the golden age of Athens. What Pericles did is there had been an alliance among many of the Greek city-states to pool their resources. This was called the Delian League, because I guess it was organized on the island of Delos. And the Delian League was set up in 477 BC. And this was an alliance of the Greek city-states against the Persians. So these city-states gave their money to Athens to hold, to build the army, to build the navies, and so on, so that they would have a common defense against the Persians. Pericles, at a certain point, decided that the Persians were no longer a problem, took all the money of the Delian League, stopped building defenses, and began to use it to build great buildings. Now, some of the great buildings that we see were built during the time of Pericles, and I'm not saying that the people who built those buildings were bad people or that these were not great buildings based on the classical principles that had been passed into Greece from the Egyptians and the Pythagoreans and so on. But the decision to stop defending Greece from the Persians was the first of many very, very bad decisions that were made by Pericles. Now, what was Pericles' problem? He was heavily influenced by the Sophists. And these are Sophists that you all know from Plato's dialogue. The main Sophist who influenced Pericles was Protagoras. And this is, actually, I was thinking about it because some of Plato's most rambunctious dialogues are about the Sophists. The Gorgias, who was another very famous Sophist, and Protagoras. If you remember some of these dialogues, the Protagoras is a very dramatic, very funny dialogue, because Socrates is awakened early in the morning by one of his young friends who says, "The great Sophist Protagoras is in town. We must go hear him." You know, and Socrates sounds like he'd like to get a few more hours of sleep, but he's dragged out of bed. And they go to somebody's house where Protagoras is holding court. You know, they have these inner courtyards. And the scene it's the funniest scene in all of Plato. Plato describes Protagoras walking across this courtyard with these sycophants, you know, following behind him like a flock of ducks. And, you know, he describes Protagoras holding forth with all these people behind him, but then he gets to the end of the courtyard. So he turns around and the flock of ducks separates and he walks back and so on. I mean, it's funny. If we ever actually stage a dramatic Plato, I'd pick the Protagoras in terms of actually, there's actual staging in it and so on. And some of the key figures in Greece at the time are present in the Protagoras dialogue, like two of Pericles' sons are there in the audience in the Protagoras dialogue. And other key people are involved in the Protagoras dialogue. Because what Plato is doing in this dialogue is he's examining the fallacies of these sophist axioms which influenced Pericles and the Athenians in making the disastrous decisions that they were about to make. The Gorgias, which is another one about one of the most famous sophists of the time, is also very dramatic, and if those of you who've read it remember, I mean, there's a couple of points in there where you actually think a fist fight is going to break out between Socrates and some of these sophists. So, I mean, there's a certain characteristic to how Plato deals with the sophists, because in a sense they are the lower order of the problem, you know, where they just say there is no truth, I'm going to teach you how to give a good speech, or Thrasymachus, who is a sophist, says, you know, might makes right, and that's how I'm going to rule society. Plato deals with Parmenides a little different because it's clearly a more serious philosophical problem. I mean, sophistry is just, you know, brutality in the form of a set of axioms, like the Straussians. I mean, the Straussians are just plain, you know, thugs, essentially, intellectually, politically, in every other way. Plato knew he had to deal with the problem that Parmenides put forward in a more serious way. And for those of you who have worked your way through the Parmenides dialogue, it is the most intense of all of Plato's dialogues. But it's written at a very, very crucial point, because it's written to take place. Now, one thing I just want to make clear. There's two chronologies you're dealing with. One is when Plato sets the dialogues. What is the time that he sets these dialogues in? And then in what order did he write them? In what order he wrote them is actually less well established than the setting of some of these dialogues. Through certain internal characteristics, the Parmenides dialogue was set to portray a meeting between Socrates and Plato in about 450 BC.
Socrates and Parmenides,
in about 450 BC. And Parmenides' sidekick, Zeno, of course, is in the dialogue as well. And it's during this period of time that the Sophists especially and also the Eleatics are having this corrosive effect on the decision-making processes of the leadership of Greece. And it comes to its culmination by 434 BC when Pericles and the Athenians have been so manipulated that they decide to launch a civil war in Greece. This is the Peloponnesian War, so-called because the peninsula where Athens and Sparta is the Peloponnesian Peninsula, just so you can keep it straight. I know some people for years kept asking me, is that the Persian War? No, the Persian War was the war against the Persians. That was earlier. This is the Peloponnesian War. This is the civil war. This is Greece's civil war. And it is an absolute disaster. Pericles' strategy for fighting this war, since Athens is a port city and could feed itself because it was, by this time, it had an imperial navy and was forcing tribute from a lot of its colonies and so on. Pericles' strategy was to build the long wall around Athens, to blockade Athens with a wall, knowing that the Spartans would lay siege, but the Athenians wouldn't starve because they were a port and they could be fed by their navy and so on. And the siege went on for years and years and years and years. Now, of course, all the people who had lived in the countryside had to flee inside of Athens, inside these long walls. So you had, you know, a huge influx of population. And what did you get? You got a plague. You had a horrible plague, which ultimately killed Pericles. So now there was a chance to end the Peloponnesian War started in 433, and there was a chance to end it in 421. There was a peace signed with the Spartans called the Peace of Nicias, spelled either. Well, spelled either N-I-C-I-A-S or N-I-K-I-A-S. And Nicias is a figure in a number of Plato's dialogues, you'll see. I can't even remember the name of one, but it's about the teaching of young people.
Lachis?
Yeah, the Lachis. And I think he's in another one as well. I think he's in at least two of Plato's dialogues. He negotiated a peace with the Spartans, and the whole thing could have ended. But the Sophists were still at it, and one of the key Sophists, Gorgias, who we've already talked about, convinced the Athenians to care. Well, think of it this way. If the first phase of the Peloponnesian War was like our first Persian Gulf War in 1991, the second phase is what we just did to Iraq. And that was an absolutely insane decision to invade Sicily and try and conquer Sicily. This was called the Sicilian Expedition in about 414, 413. And a figure that you run into in no less than four of Plato's dialogues is the key figure in that, and that is Alcibiades. Yeah.
Was Sicily held by the Spartans?
Sicily was just run by an independent, I think they were actually Greeks, it was independent Greeks, but the Athenians were in such an imperial mode, they just wanted to go out and conquer.
Even though they were at war with the Spartans?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like Donald Rumsfeld, right? No, I mean, this really was a triumph of the will, you know, kind of mentality. And what had happened by this time, because the Eleatics, because the Sophists had had such a corrosive effect on Greek society, the Athenians were consulting the Oracle of Delphi. So many of the decisions they were making in terms of the Persian War, or the Peloponnesian War, the Sicilian Expedition, and other wacky decisions they were making were because they were now listening to Fox TV. So the Sicilian Expedition, now Alcibiades, again, he shows up in four dialogues. He's in the Symposium, he's in the Protagoras, and then there's two short dialogues, Alcibiades I and Alcibiades II. And he's a very interesting figure because Socrates had great hopes for him. And you can see in Alcibiades I and Alcibiades II the hope that Socrates had that he could actually turn Alcibiades into a great leader. Alcibiades lived in the household of Pericles, so he ended up instead being heavily influenced by Protagoras and Gorgias. And Gorgias was one of the key people whipping up this Sicilian expedition. And this was a disaster. the generals in charge of it, which included Alcibiades, who wanted it, Nicias, who wasn't so sure about it, and another general who kind of got cold feet halfway there. They were fighting among themselves. There was internal politics and so on. And what ultimately happened is the Greeks ended up getting completely slaughtered. At a certain point, the remaining Greek Athenian forces in Sicily were captured. They were thrown into the bottom of a quarry. You know, they were left there for God knows how long, and then they were all slaughtered. I mean, it was a complete and total disaster. And again, I mean, when you look at the fact that there's no less than four dialogues of Plato that deal with the figure of Alcibiades, and he's writing, you know, within 30 or 40 years after this happening. I mean, this was an absolutely devastating experience for the Athenians. And the Sicilian expedition pretty much finished them off. So by 404, the Athenians had lost. They were conquered by the Spartans. And then you had complete political chaos in Athens. First you had the rule of the tyrants, then you had the rule of the democrats. Some of Plato's relatives were actually among the 30 tyrants. Critias was one of the 30 tyrants. Nobody was making good decisions in this period. It's not that the tyrants were bad and the democrats were good. The democrats were, you know, bad and the tyrants were good. Nobody was making good decisions. They were all being manipulated. And it's ultimately under the rule of the Democrats. And the Democrats are like Joe Lieberman. I mean, it's like the Democratic Party of today. That's what the Democrats of Athens were at that time. And in 399, the Democrats execute Socrates. Plato, who came from a political household and considered going into traditional politics, after witnessing the execution of Socrates, decided that he really wasn't going to do that. And this is where I say you're looking at a tragic development of Greece, but you're looking at a sublime solution, because Socrates, by refusing to betray his principles, by refusing to betray the truth, you know, neither did he grovel before his accusers, nor did he accept the offer of his friends to flee, but said, "No, I'm going to die for my city and I'm going to die for my principles." His sublime death, and Lynn has referred to his sublime death, is what inspired Plato to be something other than a common politician, to be a philosopher. Now, after the death of Socrates, Plato skedaddled out of Athens for a while, as did a lot of people. It's possible he went to Egypt. There's reports that he went to Egypt. You know, how one proves it, you know, at this point, I don't know. But by the time he got back to came back to Athens, he then decided to take the ideas which he was developing and actually put them into action. He decided he wanted to try and train a philosopher king. And he didn't have a lot of choices. Let's say the pickings were pretty slim. So he was in correspondence with the third generation Pythagoreans in Italy and in Sicily. Now, one of the key third-generation Pythagoreans was Archytas. And Plato's letters include two very short correspondences between him and Archytas. In them, Plato asks Archytas if he can find for him the works of Philolaus, the philosophical works of Philolaus, who was one of the second-generation Pythagoreans, for which we have a few fragments of Philolaus today, but obviously there was a lot more then. So one of Plato's letters to Archytas is, "Can you get me the books of Philolaus?" But he's in correspondence with the Pythagoreans in Italy, and from what he hears reports that there is a ruler in Syracuse, in Sicily, Dionysius I, whom claims to be interested in philosophy. And Plato accepts his invitation to go and try and teach him philosophy. Well, it doesn't really work. Dionysius I is not cut out to be a philosopher king. And at a certain point, severs his relationship with Plato by capturing him and threatening to sell him into slavery. This is in about 388 BC. Now, this is before the Academy. This is before any dialogues have been written. So in 388 BC, we almost lost Plato. He was almost sold into slavery. He was saved by Archytas. Archytas is the person who saved his life. And what he did at that point is he returned to Athens, and that's when he founded the Academy. And took two other trips to Sicily to try and educate another philosopher king, Dionysius II. That didn't work either. Plato's best friend was Dion, who was some relation to the Dionysiuses, and Dion seized power for a while, but then he was overthrown and assassinated and so on, and Plato was in the middle of this entire thing. So, you know, Plato is not a philosopher sitting under a tree eating grapes. You know, he's out there, you know, engaged in a real political battle. And he came back, you know, established the Academy, engaged in these political battles. The Academy continues under his nephew, whose name I can never pronounce, Susepius or something like that, Susippus, I can't remember. And a generation later, not Plato himself, but the next generation of Platonists like Menechmus and Eudoxus, working out of the Academy, become the essential teachers of Alexander the Great. Now, who is Alexander the Great? He's born in Macedonia. I mean, he wasn't born Alexander the Great. He was born Alexander. His mother was a priestess in the Egyptian temple of Ammon, which was had a colony outpost in Dodona, Macedonia. So there is a direct Egyptian connection to Alexander. And while his father, Philip of Macedon, was no good and tried to have Alexander brainwashed by Aristotle, which is why the books say that Alexander was Aristotle's pupil, the other influence was much more profound. Menechmus and Eudoxus from Plato's Academy, and Alexander essentially picked up where the battle against the Persians had left off, because during this entire period of time, when Greece is falling into civil wars and executing Socrates and engaged in this kind of turmoil, the Persians were on the march again, and they had conquered Egypt, and they had conquered most of the known world. They didn't have to bother to conquer Greece because they had it under their thumb, but they had conquered these other areas. So Alexander the Great, his campaigns last from 334 BC to 323 BC, and the area of this map, which previously was dominated by the Persians back in 490 BC at the Battle of Marathon, Alexander basically conquers all of that, takes it back, destroys the Persians, liberates Egypt. That's why you have an Alexandria in Egypt. It's Alexander's city in Egypt. He travels to the Temple of Ammon in the western desert to pay homage to his own Egyptian roots. And after he's assassinated, his general, who takes over, Ptolemy, founds the Great Library of Alexandria, which pulls together the great works of the philosophers, of the mathematicians, and so on, and continues the tradition. So if you actually look at what Plato had done, I mean, you off of the death of Socrates, Plato makes transparent, makes accessible, makes available to the human mind this method of truth-seeking, which was necessary to lay the basis for civilization. And in reality, Plato was the first youth movement in history. I mean, the first successful one. Socrates had begun this. And remember, the reason Socrates was executed, one of the crimes was he was corrupting the youth. What was he corrupting them with? The truth. So Plato picks up, and the Academy really is the first youth movement. Alexander the Great is the first real successful deployment, because he did all these things, by the way, under the age of 35. I mean, he started his campaigns in his early 20s, and this was the first youth movement. And it was a direct battle against the ideas of the Eleatics, the ideas of the Sophists, the ideas of these early-day Straussians who say there is no truth. That's what Plato was writing about. And, you know, we can talk about how to locate some of the other dialogues in this process, but every single one of these is political. For example, you think of the Mino, which we all know inside out because this is the question of doubling the area of a square. But remember the interchange that takes place in the latter part of the Mino when Anutis comes in very belligerently and says to Socrates, you know, basically, you're going to get in trouble if you keep teaching these ideas. He threatens Socrates and then he leaves. He was one of Socrates' accusers. He was one of the people who ensured that Socrates later got executed. And what you find in most of the dialogues is either a direct reference to this political battle or simply the epistemological battle is the subject of the actual dialogue. So there is nothing, you know, when there is absolutely nothing boring or academic about Plato's dialogues. They are combat manuals. They were written in a period of combat in terms of the kind of intellectual combat that had to be waged to save civilization. They did. They laid the basis for every great breakthrough that has taken place since then, and we are standing on their shoulders. The people who should be underneath our toes are the Straussians, you know, and the Eleatics and the Sophists, because, frankly, Plato dealt with them 2,500 years ago. And, you know, the way that we have intervened against these Straussians by simply chopping them to pieces, because we know Plato, either they don't know Plato or they're lying about Plato, would make Plato and Socrates very proud. So we ought to finish the job, and we ought to do it soon. So, I can take lots of questions. Who was first? The very back.
I didn't talk about the idea of the Nicomachean dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the first actual written text or representation of consubstantiality. So my question is, what is consubstantiality and how does that represent the Nicomachean and also the Parmenides?
Well, that's a simple first question, isn't it? I'm not going to try and answer that question, except to say that what the Timaeus does is it unfolds the idea that it is the intention of the creator, which is the generating principle that ultimately creates the physical universe, and unfolds it from the standpoint of the difference between the visible universe, the shadows, which are represented by the Platonic solids, and the generating process that actually creates it. The Timaeus and the Parmenides are the two most intense and dense of Plato's dialogues. And exactly how Lynn addresses the question of consubstantiality through them, I think I'm going to let you ask Lynn. Yeah, Nick.
Who's Mino?
I'm not sure if he was actually a real character. Right. Don't leave home without this book. It's just called Who's Who in the Greek World. And not everybody in the dialogues is an actual identifiable person. I don't remember Mino, so let's
who
just...
Was that book?
This is it's by John Hazel, Hazel. There's a whole lot of these, you know, who's who in Egypt, who's who in Nazi Germany, see if that's any good. Who's who in the New Testament, you know. Who's who in Charles Dickens, but I'd recommend this one. I also have Ancient Egypt. Mino, 4th B.C., I don't know if this is going to be the same one because it sounds like he's a little late. There is a Mino who was a pupil of Aristotle who wrote a summary of the various doctrines of medicine known in his day. I don't think it's the same Mino. I don't see any echoes of that Mino. So as I say, some of the figures in Plato's dialogues are not identifiable historically. A lot of them are. Yeah.
The way I used to think you find truth in history, I've always wondered how the heck does LaRouche know these things about 4,000 years ago?
it's, I always thought, you know, you have to go back, try to find original sources, and then do all that. But it seems like what Linda's saying, to me anyways, is that that's looking at the shadows on the wall. Really what you have to do is find out how people think, and then from there, since you're human too, you know, everybody's got a mind, you can see how history would progress and do it that way.
Yeah.
So how would you study what you would have to study Aristotle and Plato first and get those two concepts really down to understand universal history, or how do you do that?
Well, I think if you just work your way through Plato, because you actually don't have to study the other guys all that much. I mean, it becomes quite transparent how ridiculous their ideas are when you actually do immerse yourself in Plato. And that is how Lynn does it. I mean, I was saying the other night that Lynn could read the Parmenides in the worst translation you could possibly imagine. And when I read it, I couldn't make hide nor tail of it. He read it in the worst translation you could possibly imagine, and he knew what it meant. He didn't need to read the original Greek. I needed to look at the Greek before I could figure out, you know, some of the more intense concepts. But he knows how Plato's mind works. It's what he talks about in terms of the simultaneity of eternity. He knows Plato. He knows how Plato's mind works. And that is the only way you can study history. You have to go to the characteristic of the ideas. Because, first of all, in many cases, when you get into ancient history, there are no original sources. And, you know, secondly, the original sources are only footprints or shadows and are not necessarily the whole picture. So the best way to study history, to my mind, is to read all of Plato's dialogues and then to read all of Plato's dialogues again and then to read all of Plato's dialogues again. Because your ability to think in the simultaneity of eternity is just constantly nourished and intensified by Plato's dialogues. And then as you do that, you begin to see the richness of the historical battle, which is reflected in the dialogues. But I went out and bought, you know, got some books from Interlibrary Loan about the history of Plato and so on. Forget it. I mean, it's useless. You learn Plato by knowing Plato. Yeah.
While I was in Mexico, I heard a reference to something called Vieta de Dionisio, which was Dionysius II. Do you have any idea what that reference is?
No, I haven't heard of that. Was that what? Yeah. Yeah, that's the Egyptian name for itself. It means black earth, I think, and it reflects the black earth of the Nile, K-E-M-E-T. Although, again, here's another interesting one in terms of, you know, shadows on the wall. The Egyptian language, which obviously when you speak it, it has vowels. The written hieroglyphic language doesn't have any vowels in it. So, you know, yeah, it just has consonants. You can't speak a language without vowels. So the Kemet is actually just KMT, is what the hieroglyphic would actually look like. Yeah, Mike.
On this language thing, how can we know the development of the Greek language and the written language? You know, and thinking about how it's supposed to be a colony of Egypt.
Well, I mean, from the standpoint of knowing language and knowing the relationship between societies, you know, again, it's in the domain of the continuous manifold. We know how the human mind works. I mean, that is why Lynn knows these things. He knows how the human mind actually works. He knows what has to go on for a society to develop successfully. He knows what is the characteristic you have to look for, which could give you the connection between Greece and Egypt. And Plato tells you, I mean, in all of his dialogues, the Timaeus, the Laws, and elsewhere, he's constantly pointing back to Egypt as the origin of it. I think Ted and I were having this discussion the other night because Ted finally asked me. I knew, you know, this had been getting him for a while. He said, so you really think that the origin of classical Greece is Egypt? And I said, I think the origin of Greek science, geometry, philosophy, I think the method of knowing the universe comes from Egypt. But the Egyptians did not make the breakthroughs that the Greeks did. I mean, I don't think there's some hidden Plato in Egypt that we just haven't found. The Egyptians, I mean, there was a fundamental breakthrough made in classical Greece, in statecraft, in philosophy, and so on. I think, my hypothesis, it's the combination of the ideas that come from Egypt and the Indo-European language, which has embedded in it the ability to communicate profound concepts regarding man and nature. And I think it's the interaction between those two things which created this apparent miracle in Greece. That's my hypothesis.
Do you know how, up to what date they still used the hieroglyphs?
Fairly late, but what they also did is they had some what they called hieratic script, where they sort of had hieroglyphics, but it was turned more into writing. They were certainly using hieroglyphics at the time of Christ and later.
It seems kind of hard to have a Platonic dialogue written in hieroglyphs.
Yeah, well, they didn't have any.
Yeah.
See, again, it was the communication of the astronomy, the geometry, the science. That's what we know came from Egypt.
And if Pythagoras and Thales were in Egypt, they must have been speaking in a common language.
It was by that time it was probably Greek.
Yeah.
Because the you had Greek colonies in Egypt and so on. Yeah, in the back. Oh, Danny.
In you referenced Plato trying to organize Dionysius II of Syracuse. When he was doing that, it said, I can't prove it, but that he had, Dionysius had written him and asked for an analysis of the Athenian constitution. He sent him back the complete works of Aristophanes. And also there was supposedly, according to the myth and legends surrounding his death, he died with the complete works of Aristophanes.
Plato?
Yeah. And also the symposium, the portrayal of Aristophanes seems to be much more favorable than many amongst our ranks seem to give Aristophanes credit for, which obviously is because of the clouds, which is attacking Socrates. So I was wondering, do you have any insight into why the clouds were written, or and anything around that as far as either clearing up Aristophanes' good name?
No, I don't know enough Aristophanes to actually come to an independent conclusion on that. Next time you get Tony Papert anywhere near you, ask him. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, what is the connection between a sophist like Parmenides and one like Gorgias? Because Gorgias to me is entertaining to listen to him in a way that this is what we encounter on campuses talking to students all the time. But Parmenides, would this be more on the level of a Leo Strauss, is that?
Yeah, I think it's probably a legitimate comparison. Parmenides was, if you look at the seriousness with which Plato treats Parmenides in the Parmenides dialogue, he obviously takes this as a much more serious intellectual challenge, threat, however you want to look at it. He knows he's got to take this very, very seriously. He knows he's got to work through absolutely rigorously every element of Parmenides' problem in the Parmenides dialogue. He certainly knows he's got to deal with the sophists. He's got to deal with Gorgias and Protagoras and so on, but he they are more of the entertainers. They're dangerous because they entertained Athens into, deciding to destroy itself. But and I think it probably is the reason that when Lynn found this, honed in. Wasn't it like a heat-seeking missile? When he found this Leo Strauss thing, he knew that this, he knew that this actually. He treats Leo Strauss, in a sense, in the way that Plato treats Parmenides. This has to be dealt with very, very, very seriously. People have got to understand what the epistemological virus is that starts this whole process into going. Because again, Parmenides doesn't say there is no truth. That's why I say he has to take it more seriously. He just says you can't know it.
Susan,
just to give you this from in terms of this primate, and this is in a relatively unsophisticated thing. Remember, he's just sort of in a back and forth. I'll give you two quotes from Strauss. It's very funny. The Jewish people and their fate are the living witness for the absence of redemption. This one could say is the meaning of the chosen people. The Jews are chosen to prove the absence of redemption. The greatest expression, surpassing everything that any present day man could write, is a great Jewish prayer which will be known to some of you and which is a stumbling block to many, Olenu Lishabeah. I think that means the world to come, I don't know, or something like that. I'm not sure. It would be absolutely, or the world to be sanctified. That's probably closer to it. It would be absolutely improper for me to read it now. Now, let us reflect for a few moments more. Be patient about delusion. What is a delusion? We also say a dream. No nobler dream was ever dreamt. It is surely nobler to be the victim of the most noble dream than to profit from a sordid reality and wallow in it. Dream is akin to aspiration. An aspiration is a kind of divination of an enigmatic vision. And an enigmatic vision, in the emphatic sense, is the perception of the ultimate mystery of the truth of the ultimate mystery. The truth of the ultimate mystery, that there is an ultimate mystery, that being is radically mysterious, cannot be denied by the unbelieving Jew. And then he says, at the end, and then he says, and a little, so you get a sense, there is a truth, but it is mysterious. It's so you can only know it if you have some kind of special way of knowing, which is exactly what these guys believe. Who knows what the handshake is that gets you into it? I don't know. But then he says in sort of a little bit more mundane way at the very end, science, as the positivist understands it, is susceptible of infinite progress. That you learn in every elementary school today, I believe. Every result of science is provisional and subject to future revision, and this will never change. In other words, the truth is, 50,000 years from now, there will still be results entirely different from those now, but still subject to revision. Science is susceptible of infinite progress. All right, now, but how can science be susceptible of infinite progress if its object does not have an inner infinity? In other words, the object of science is everything that is being. The belief admitted by all believers in science today that science is by its nature essentially progressive and eternally progressive implies, without saying it is, that being is mysterious. And here is the point where the two lines I have tried to trace do not exactly meet, but where they come within hailing distance. And I believe to expect more in a general way of people in general would be unreasonable. So yeah. It's mystery.
Yeah.
And that is what makes him different. The sophist is just saying, it's all, forget it. If I can fool you, I can fool you. If I can pull it off, I can pull it off. A Strauss, like Parmenides, has a much more constructed path that leads you to say, there's a mysterious knowledge and maybe you'll be let in. There are the knowers.
Yeah. I mean, if you actually, you can get Parmenides' poem called The Way of the Truth. Every time I need it, I just do a web search and you can find a copy of it. And Strauss had to have read it. Because, it starts out, the beautiful steeds take me up to the, mysterious gates of heaven and the goddess opens the door and lets me in, and that's where I find out the mysteries, that you can't know the truth through your senses. It's the whole poem doesn't exist, but the essential part does, and it's actually worth reading it. It's actually worth reading it because that is where Leo Strauss and Nazism comes from. Yeah.
I had a question for you or for Phil. Linz issued several times a statement about having people impeached or calling for their resignation, but I got a feeling that this time going after Rumsfeld, this isn't just kind of a cover of the EIR. I got a feeling there's gonna be huge mobilization. I was wondering what the difference, why this time? Is it because that there's so much vulnerability coming out of the administration?
Well, I think it's that, but I also think we're at a point where we now have demonstrable political power. I mean, the fact that we are the biggest campaign in the United States, the fact that Lynn said, I'm going to move the institutions of the presidency, and that's what he's done for the last 4 months. Now he's saying, I'm going to move the institution of the Congress, because that's why he's chosen this fight. Remember, last October, when all the peace demonstrations were, you know, lobbying Congress to stop the war with Iraq, what did Lynn say? He said, forget it. You know, they're going to capitulate. I'm not going to concentrate on the Congress. It's a waste of time. I'm going to intervene into the institution of the presidency. And he did. We've created a resistance. We have a counter-coup going on now. You know, we've moved policy-making institutions like the New York Times and, you know, Lawrence Eagleburger, for God's sake. But we also have our own power now. This, you know, demonstrable power. And now he's saying we're going to move, you know, the legislative institutions. They're now going to be pushed into this fight as well, because Congress hasn't. It's been flat on its back. So I think the difference now is, yeah, they're vulnerable, but I think the difference is Lynn knows we actually can do it. We have the power, the political power in the United States to actually do it now.
So Pryor's kind of was more of a sense of just building up a building.
Pryor,
up
it was, you know, yeah, saying what needs to be done in the universe, but you didn't quite have the power yet to do it. Yeah.
This is about the Pythagoreans. You mentioned that Pythagoras went to an island off of Italy after he left Egypt, and that they were slaughtered. His colony was slaughtered.
Yeah, it's not actually an island. It's on the mainland, Croton. There's a map in my article.
Okay. All right. now you said some of them escaped, so I'm assuming they went back to the mainland, Greece.
Some of this figure Philolaus is a very interesting figure, because of the first generation Pythagoreans, I mean, obviously a few of them escaped. Pythagoras apparently did not die in that attack. He either escaped or he wasn't there, but he died shortly thereafter. One of the key names that we do know of the next generation of Pythagoreans was Philolaus, and he stayed in Italy, as far as I know. Now, it's really quite beautiful, because if you remember the Phaedo dialogue, you know, which is the dialogue which discusses where Socrates discusses the question of the soul and the death of Socrates. Who are the two key people he's talking to in that? Cebes and Simmias. They're the ones that the debate over the soul, you know, is the most intense throughout the entire thing. They are identified as students of Philolaus. Yeah.
You mentioned a follower of Alexander and Ptolemy. That wasn't Kepler's Ptolemy.
No,
was it?
Okay. No. Every time I bring this up, it gets people very confused. There were a whole lot of Ptolemies and there were a whole lot of Cleopatras. Okay. I mean, the Ptolemies and the Cleopatras were father and daughter, you know, and so on, and they ruled Egypt. Like the Cleopatra that we unfortunately all know in the form of Elizabeth Taylor.
No.
Which is really too bad, because that was Cleopatra the VII. And she was literate in 7 languages or 8 languages, and was trying to maintain the independence of Egypt from the Romans. And that's really what that story is all about. So there were a lot of Ptolemies, there were a lot of Cleopatras, but the Ptolemy, the astronomer, is none of the above.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
I've just recently come across Shadia's Drury's book, mm-hmm. Poja.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's her connection to all this postmodernist Frankfurt School crowd?
I actually don't know anything about her in particular. I mean, we've certainly been happy to use her research, and whether we're in touch with her or not, I don't know, but I actually don't know anything about her.
The only thing I know is her claim to fame, which is she was a Straussian who basically finally decided that there's something bad here and took it upon herself to expose somewhat from the inside, because she was a student of the Strauss. She was a Straussian. I forget which one she was trained by.
She says in her book that she's not a student. She never attended any classes by Strauss.
Yeah.
No, not by Strauss. But I think she went to places where Straussians taught.
Yeah, she collaborated with...
No, I didn't mean she was taught. She was taught by, and she may never consider herself a Straussian, but she was taught by people who were students of Strauss. And at a certain point, she did take, as I understood it from a review, an interview with her, she took it upon herself to expose what she began to feel. You know, she didn't just treat it I'm being taught by these people and I got to pass the courses. She got at some point upset with what she was being whole and looked into it further. So she may not have gotten Strauss directly. She was looking into some of the things she was being taught, which she discovered was coming from Strauss. And then she did some stuff to, you know, check some of these people out. But Kojève is a different... I didn't even know she wrote a book with Kojève.
It's on Amazon.com.
They go bankrupt for it.
Okay, go read Plato.